This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that did learn life from Bugs Bunny. This is the mad prophet of the podcasting, Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
Hi, I'm Kent, a podcasting lackey of the Imperialist Ruling Circles.
Hey, this is Chris, and the next time I send out a marketing analysis, you all better read it or I'll sack the fucking lot of you.
In this episode, we're discussing Network, starring Faye Dunaway, William Holden, Peter Finch, Robert Duvall, Ned Beatty, and directed by Sidney Lumet. So, we are now down to what I want to say is one of the strangest Oscar-nominated and Oscar-winning films of all time. It's interesting also that we're talking about yet another movie from 1976 that was nominated for an Oscar, because we've already done Rocky, and we did Nashville. Now we're doing Network. Gentlemen, out of curiosity, how were you made aware of this movie, and did you see it before watching it for this podcast?
Did not see it before. Something tells me I've heard of it before, but I can't place where.
Did you find yourself mad as hell, maybe?
That probably was it, that clip getting re-aired somewhere.
What about you, Chris?
I had not watched it before, and I hadn't even heard of it before. I had heard the quote before. I didn't realize it was from this movie.
Really?
Yeah.
So I should say that Network is a movie that I had heard about back in the 90s, but I didn't actually watch it until I had my Netflix queue in the mid-2000s. And I was going through a bunch of Sidney Lumet movies. Now, I should let you know right now, I have a love-hate relationship with Lumet. For every one of the movies that Sidney Lumet has made that I love, there's one that I'm not a big fan of. That said, though, the movies that he's done that I love, I really love. And when we get to the Geek Sheet, I will gush over those types of movies. Specifically, I think the one that I think everyone knows the best is probably his version of 12 Angry Men, which Henry Fonda was a part of.
At
some point, I would love to talk about that movie. I feel that is just a classic film in its own right. But at the same time, though, Network has to be possibly one of the most ambitious films ever made. And that is saying something, considering that the screenwriter for this movie is Paddy Chayefsky. Now, are y'all familiar with Paddy Chayefsky's work?
I'm not.
It doesn't seem... checking his stuff now, and doesn't seem familiar.
Now, Chayefsky was actually a writer back in the 50s in the age of television. He was one of the most prominent television writers of the early age. And the thing is that he had actually gotten disillusioned from television and what television was being used for, and he went into writing film scripts. Specifically, he was the screenwriter for Marty, which was also an Academy Award winner. He has won 3 Academy Awards for Best Original Screenplay that only he wrote. Now, this is something that he didn't have a co-writer for, and this is something that it makes him pretty much the quintessential screenwriter of all time. Aaron Sorkin credits him as being a major influence. In fact, he has actually mentioned Paddy Chayefsky in several of his scripts, which, especially after this one, I'm pretty sure you can see why he would give him such credit. But Network is a movie that, even though I was prepared for something interesting, there was no way on earth that I could understand just how batshit crazy this movie was. And I got it. Now, without tipping your hand about what you think about the film, Did you expect the film to get as crazy as it did?
You know what's scary is I didn't think things were too crazy until the very end. In retrospect, it gets batshit crazy, but I'm just so used to the crazy of nowadays that I'm like, yeah, I could see that. I could see that. Yep.
Chris, I want to give you a chance to respond, but I do want to say, I mean, Kent, you were there when we discussed Face in the Crowd. And I will say that, in my opinion, Network and Face in the Crowd make a great double feature.
Oh.
Because both films show the insane power that television could have in shaping opinions, right?
You know what's scary is this afternoon I was thinking this movie could almost be a prequel to a not necessarily classic, or maybe it is classic. In some ways, it's felt like a Running Man prequel.
You think that this is a prequel to Running Man?
Think about it. Just how crazy some of that stuff starts becoming. It has to start somewhere.
I don't know if I'd go
if we're facing the crowd, you can almost create a line where it just goes through time like that.
I'm gonna have to think about it later. Accept that is a thing. But
just nod your head and move on.
But Chris, what about you? Did you expect this movie to get as crazy as it did?
I did not. I did not have any idea what I was in for. But like early on, it was reminding me of a movie from, I think it was from 2016, that movie Christine, with Rebecca Hall. Yeah, which I guess was based on a true story, and the true story inspired the end of the film, according to IMDb.
Really?
So, the thing is, I don't want to spoil a movie, but yet at the same time, though, considering that this was based on a true event, but Christine actually was about a woman who shot herself on live television, who killed herself on live television. And this film definitely plays with that, and you could definitely tell that it was inspired by that particular event, even if you didn't read about it.
Right.
Because this, I love how this movie, and I have to understand that this movie is a very dense movie. There is so much going on in this movie. It surprises me that this movie is only about 2 hours long, right? Because there is so much happening. There are, three major subplots, or three major plots that are happening at the same time that is intertwined and intermingled, and it actually all culminates into the end. You have six or seven major characters, not to mention, you know, you have major stars as well as faces that you probably not seen before, right?
Yeah.
And of course, the acting. This is some heavy acting that we're getting from these actors, right? And one thing that was really surprising to me, watching it for this time with all the film knowledge that I've had experienced between the time that I saw it back in the day to now, is that you have different styles of acting kind of being played out here. Because, you know, Peter Finch and William Holden, they come from the old Hollywood style. You know, the style of movies that we would talk about with, like, Billy Wilder and the more grandiose acting. Whereas you have Faye Dunaway and Robert Duvall, who are method actors, right? They come from the 70s style of acting. And yet at the same time, each of these actors are bringing something different with their style, and they're all kind of clashing with one another, and yet it feels all natural to an extent, right? Or did you see any kind of differences in the acting approaches?
There were times I thought Finch was more method acting when he was really getting into the preacher of the airwaves.
Oh, no. He is... Yeah. Peter Finch is definitely of the old school.
Yeah.
And I guess it should also be mentioned that Peter Finch actually died just months after filming this movie. In fact, he died right after getting the nomination for Best Actor. He would go on to win. He'd be the first actor to receive the award posthumously, which, of course, he won't be the last one, considering that, you know, a few years later, or about 30 years later, we had Heath Ledger, who won for Best Supporting Actor for The Dark Knight. But out of curiosity, did you know about Peter Finch's death prior to watching the movie, or did it affect how you saw the movie, knowing that this would be it, that he would be dead just after this film was made?
That was kind of a surprise to find out he died after this, but because I saw one more credit on his IMDb, and I'm like, oh, well, he lived a little longer after... no. I think that other movie just came out after, so...
Yeah, well, I mean, it should be said that the last Anton Yelchin film that he made is coming out this month.
Yeah.
Which I'm actually very excited about.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler, it's not very...
Hey, don't start with that.
Oh.
Anton Yelchin is good, and you'll miss him after you see the movie, but the movie is not very good.
I'm actually going to go in still eager because the movie Thoroughbreds, I don't know, it's just something about it just looks really intriguing, and I'm hoping. But anyway, let's get back to Network. So, yeah, let's dive into this fucker because this is going to be wow. I have to admit, when it comes to movies that start off with voiceover, especially a narrator, that all automatically gets me on a defensive position. Because, let's be honest here, if you have to use a narrator to start things off, it usually means that it's some, especially if it's something that you could probably show and not have to really tell, that's poor writing, right? That in itself would probably give you, or at least it would give me kind of a hesitation towards whether this is going to be a good movie or not. Yet at the same
It felt reminiscent to me of TV at that time.
Well, that's part of it, but the thing is that what I found myself doing was I was thinking about if they were to just show this instead of say it, how long would it take for them to do that? How much setup would they have to build this?
Yeah,
you know, it would have probably taken 5 minutes to get through this in some sort of natural way. Whereas here, you could just have someone just kind of give us this information. This isn't even the most interesting stuff, but this is basically just kind of throwing us into the middle of it, but at least giving us just enough to know kind of what the hell is going on, right? And I love the fact that the first scene that we have is actually just a tie-in to the voiceover, with you have Howard and Max drunk, and you get the genesis of the idea that would basically set this whole story into motion, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of going into that, kind of seeing, and also this is setting up a character moment between Howard and Max, and this is also something that I realized now about the film itself, is this is a movie that's all about characters clashing with one another, or I don't think that there's ever a scene where it's not more than one person kind of in kind of communicating with someone else, right? Because, even with, like, when it comes to Howard and the camera, he's still talking to more, he's not just talking to himself, he's talking to someone else. When Howard's having his visions, he's talking to someone else, whether that person's there or not, visibly speaking, is kind of beyond the point. But there's always some sort of conflict going on in the scene. Is that, do y'all see that, or is do you think that I'm missing a point?
No, I think you're right.
And for that to go into it, and that to especially to tie in straight, I mean, the movie goes straight from the drunken scene where you have Max kind of agreeing with Peter about the idea of, you should talk about killing, you should kill yourself on air. We can get a 40 share off of that.
Sure. Yeah.
And I also love how it puts the jargon in there in ways that it'll help you understand what they mean, right? Because, I mean, before you see this movie, did you ever have an idea what a share is in regards to television, or what a point is in the demographic?
A point is, I believe it's how many million people are watching.
Yeah, but did you know that before?
Yes. Share, I still don't quite get, but...
I was vague going in, and I was vague coming out, so,
Yeah.
But the film made you, gave you enough information that you knew that a bigger share is a good thing, a lower share is a bad.
Oh, yeah.
Right, yeah.
And it did it in a way that didn't dumb down for the audience. You didn't have someone explaining what a share is or what a point is. It just kind of dropped you into it and go, okay, we want a 40 share, we want a 100 share, we want the points to go up. If we lose like 4 points, then that's a bad thing. Things of that nature, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so as we get into, because this is all going to be very important to what's going to happen later on, that to kind of get that out of the way, and then to get into Howard's proposal to kill himself on air. And I love just how matter-of-factly he does it, right? Like, even the people in the booth are like, did he just say what he thought he said?
No, most of them didn't even say that. Most of them don't even notice.
They were just still talking, like it never even fucking happened. They didn't give a shit. And somebody runs in and fucking is like, what the fuck is he doing?
Well, another thing that I love about the booth sequences is that you still have the screen, the monitor that is showing Howard, and you're actually still hearing Howard talk even while the other actors in the scene itself are kind of responding to it, right? And then of course you hear the phone ringing, and the film lets you know without even telling you the phone ringing is important. This isn't just some background noise to give you the atmosphere of being in a newsroom. If someone's calling, that means something really bad is happening or is about to happen, right? I mean, anytime that a phone rings in this movie, it's never just background noise, right?
Right.
And I love how this all plays out, and I love how the chaos of everything you just get this sense of just the insanity of what's about to happen. I love how, they talk about how the reporters are at the, in the lobby of the UBS building, which, of course, the idea of, these reporters from, like, CBS and NBC. I love the fact that even before that first scene, we see the various televisions, and we have Howard Beale right next to Walter Cronkite, tying it into the real world, tying it into the fact that this UBS, this fictional television station, is on the same par as these very legendary news reporters, right? Yes, no, maybe.
Mean, it's just establishing it's the same world. So, because I recognize those other guys as like I saw them on TV when I was young. So,
but I think it's also because when they talk about the reporters in the lobby, I just find it kind of funny that. I could just see them like going across the street, just having the reporters go across the street over to the UBS building to basically make news of a rival. And of course, when we have, CNN or Fox News today kind of doing something obnoxious or getting into the news themselves instead of the news that they're reporting, the same exact thing happens to them, right?
Well, not exactly, but
oh,
yeah.
Actually, I disagree. I think that's one of the things that makes this movie as timeless as it is that it's prophetic. It actually...
Right.
These are things that at that point were considered comedic and goofy and funny. This happens in real life now. I mean, you could say that UBS and the Howard Beale show that this creates is practically just the beginning of the syndicated talk news circuits. I mean, Fox News could have been built off of what the Howard Beale show is, right?
Oh, yeah.
And another thing that I love about this film is that it incorporates something that was happening at the time and that was actually happening just before, just before this film was made, which was that the newsrooms were being enveloped by the regular programming, that the news channels were no longer considering the news to be something that they could that they had to lose money on, but that they could kind of that they can develop and make it interesting enough that they could actually get that people would actually want to watch the news, and that they would want to that you could get advertising for, right? I mean, that's when we started to see investigative journalism, eyewitness news, the sound bites of carnage and mayhem happening, and if it bleeds, it leads. Kind of a mentality of news, right? This is the birthplace of all that.
The '70s. But yeah, and news was supposed to be a loss leader, so. But
Ken, I mean, you were around at that particular point. I mean, I don't know if you were old enough to really be noticing the news at that time, but did you kind of see some of where this was, going?
Some of my first memories, honestly, were watching the news about the Iran hostage crisis.
Yeah.
So that was all news. So, and then growing up in the 80s, of course, early 80s, it wasn't much different than, not much had really changed since the 70s. So still, yeah. I mean, I was there when Entertainment Tonight first hit, which was all kind of a couple of the segments that are in the Howard Beale show, where they discuss, well, what if we spun these off? Yeah, that's what you get when you spin off some of those segments.
Well, that's true. And, of course, if we're going to be talking about these types of shows, and especially the Howard Beale show, we have to talk about Faye Dunaway and her character.
Yeah.
Because this character is that idea of merging entertainment with news, right? Her idea is to blend the news into entertainment, to turn it into, instead of making news something boring, something that, I guess you could say the vegetables to the candy of other prime time, but to kind of mix the fact and fiction to create this hybrid, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
What are your opinions about her professionalism and what her aims are professionally? We'll get into her private life in just a little bit, but as a professional, what did you think about what she represents?
She is definitely out for number one.
Well, that's true, but
she is climbing the elevator. She's trying to. She's seen a good. I mean, she's willing to take a chance to seize power. I mean, nobody else is like, oh, well, Beale's just gone insane. Hey, Beale is ratings. Let's take it.
Oh, no. That wasn't Diana. That was Hackett. Hackett was the one that said, fuck Beale. Okay, and we'll be talking about Hackett in just a little bit.
Yeah.
But do you think that she's cynical in her aims to merge news with entertainment? Are you saying that she's doing this kind of not giving a shit about the news?
Maybe in her own way she feels it's all bullshit anyway. Because, like, she points out, you only had a minute of hard news.
Well, that's part of it, but here's some things that I find very interesting when you say that, though. Diana is paying attention to the news. When she's talking about, like with the whole Howard Beale saying the word shit, right? She mentions, all these things are happening in the world today, yet the front page is Howard Beale saying the word shit. Her idol is Max. Right, she makes it very clear that that she looked up to him as a figure of admiration, that she had a crush on it, and crush on what he represents. And they make it very clear that Max is of the old school. Max and Howard are throwaways from the old age of Edward R. Murrow and that kind of hard hitting journalism of the 50s. Right.
Yeah.
You know, these were the pioneers of television news. And she admires that. And she makes that very clear. Unless you think that she's not being sincere, yet Max remembers the conference that he made in at St. Louis that, you know, she happened to be at, right? So do you think that she's being, you know, that she's playing to his ego, or do you think that there is something that she admires? And understands, not only does she have sex with him, she moves him in, and she didn't have to.
I think those parts were honest.
Okay, so wouldn't it be safe to say that she has an admiration for the news? Maybe that she's just wanting to change the approach to news to make the news entertaining so that more people watch?
I think it's all just to gain her power and fame inside the network, which is her career. So
what about you, Chris?
She wants to make...
Where do you lie on this?
In a way, I think she may have some sort of, sees some sort of positive aspects in the news, but mostly just wants a number one show.
Well, she doesn't want just one number one show. I mean, when we get to that board meeting, she's talking about having the top five. You know, and it's not just the Howard Beale show. I mean, she also has the Mao Zedong Hour, right?
She's
getting the liberation movement. You know, their home videos and making a heist of the week show off of their videos.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear some of her other pitches that she's trying to get across. She wants counterculture. She wants to go against the normal stuff. She wants to kind of scoff at, you know, the normal stuff that you would see on the other stations, and she wants to go against that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
she wants to offer something different, I guess, like a different product.
And again, look at just the liberation movement and the Mao Zedong Hour that she's trying to put together. It's not political, and she makes it very clear that she's not politically motivated. But what is she doing? She's taking real life events and she's putting a narrative spin on it. She's taking news and she's providing it to people that wouldn't have known about it if she hadn't been showing it, which I think is showing that she has an interest in news. The thing is, she doesn't want to just give the news as it's normally presented. She wants to find a new way to get the news out. And I think that that's a large drive of what she's doing, right?
A new way, her way of getting the news out is to allow the criminals to put out their own releases.
Oh, no. It's even worse than that.
I mean,
technically speaking, what they're doing is they're conspiring with these terrorists, and we should put that very clear. They're working with terrorists who go around terrorizing people and robbing banks, which is kind of hilarious considering that Faye Dunaway's big claim to fame was playing Bonnie in Bonnie and Clyde. Just a bit of inside baseball there. But basically, this news station is protecting them. They know where these people are. They know that they're going to be doing these. And yet they're using the freedom of the press to protect their source. You see the issue here?
Yeah. They're making money off of it. It's one thing to just get the story. It's another thing to, let's charge advertising.
Well, we never hear that this liberation movement has killed anybody. But just imagine if they had.
They have kidnapped.
Well, they have kidnapped. But the heiress at this particular point, and this is literally, I love that they even call out.
It's a copy-paste.
Situation. And I also love that, you know, there's all these liberation movements out there, you know, that are just kidnapping their own heiresses and doing this. So,
everybody just kidnapping
her with them at this particular point. She is throwing her lot in with them, and of course the great Ahmed Khan, which I just the name itself and the fact that this is this big old guy that sits down and just doesn't really do much, right? Well, with the exception of the end, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But this channel knows where they are. I love the fact that, you know, if you're paying attention to what Faye Dunaway's talking about, she even brings it up. Yeah, the FBI and the police want us to turn over the videos, and they want us to, you know, and they're going to charge us if we don't help them, you know, catch these people. But we're holding to our First Amendment rights and protecting our sources and things of that nature.
Down to the corner and down.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But at the same time, though, the, you know, she's not thinking just of this particular one show. She's working on building a whole empire. She's going to take UBS and, well, honestly, she's going to make it Fox News. You know, I mean, not in politics, but in just bombastity. She's going to bastardize news and the ethics of news journalism in order to make it sensational. She's going to take the needs of news, the what people need to know, and she's going to turn it into what you want to know, right?
Right.
Because it's not like she's going to be doing. She's not going to put the same amount of effort into reporting on city council meetings as she does bank robberies, right? She's not going to give needed presidential announcements the same type of energy as she does with, you know, with something violent, something kinetic happening, right? And look at what Howard Beale does. Howard Beale, if you look, did y'all actually, when y'all listen to Howard Beale and his proclamations, doesn't he sound a little bit like maybe John Oliver or, you know, just the way that he takes these, you know, like the whole CIA, the parent company mergers, and the way that he just blows it up into out of proportion.
Oh yeah,
and getting people to write their congressman, write the White House, and, you know, I don't know. Part of me just thought of go FCC yourself. You know, that whole campaign a little bit.
I mean, I forgot people ever sent telegrams. It did feel like a late night talk show host thing.
Well, also remember that scene in Facing the Crowd where he where he had all the local people sending their dogs to the dog catcher, basically kind of taunt the dogs to the local sheriff, right? As kind of as a prank, right? But at the same time, though, Beale is being very serious, or as serious as someone who definitely is suffering a psychotic break can be considered.
Yeah.
All right. So, okay, we've been dancing around. Let's talk about Howard and what happens to Howard. So, you know, he doesn't go through with it, with the suicide, obviously. But then he has his mad as hell moment. The one line I think all of us, and I think that the film is most well known for, right?
I'm mad as hell.
And what are you gonna do with it?
Yeah. I believe I shall not take it any longer. No.
Yeah. yeah.
But I'm that is basically the battle cry of a lot of, you know, talk news today, so it could sum it all up to that one line.
But I mean, did y'all pay one thing I love about how this particular scene happens is, first off, Howard is in his pajamas.
Yeah,
he's in the pajamas and a raincoat, and he's on television. I also love the fact that even when you're not watching him in on the soundstage, you're watching him on the television screen. You know, when they cut back to the booth, when you cut back to everyone watching it on their television screens, you're seeing it. And I love the fact that the movie filmed both the television aspects of Howard Beale's rant, and yet at the same time you also have the meta camera, right? So you're getting it from two different perspectives, right?
Right.
And I have to admit, there's something about just the way that Peter Finch nails this. And understand that this is a drastic change in Howard. Right up to this particular point, he seems rational and sane. He goofs off about it. You know, they are setting him up as the quote unquote mad, the mad prophet of the airwaves. And, you know, oh, I'll be the mad prophet. Why not? And, you know, I'll make some hay out of this. And then, of course, he has the voice from God. Right. And I love the fact that the exact thing that he talked about, you know, that hearing the voice and the voice telling him that he has to tell these things to the audience is the exact same thing Ned Beatty is going to give back to him in what I consider to be the best scene in Network, which we'll get to in just a little bit. But what is your opinion of the Mad as Hell scene?
I mean, it's kind of... kind of the scene that is kind of like really, I mean, as the movie was going on, I was becoming more and more interested, but that was the scene that really just kind of reeled me in, I guess. And
that was the pin on the grenade, right? That was when they,
yeah,
because that's when the movie kicks into overdrive, and from here on the movie just gets crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like especially like when the next time you're on the sound stage. And, you know, they remove the desk and, you know, all the trappings of a newsroom. And it looks like a game show. Right? I mean, you have, like, theme song and you have, you know, the announcer. And you have the live studio audience. Right? This is, you know, you would almost think that this is The Price is Right for a moment, right?
That theme song used to be a ringtone, I think.
I think you can probably find it somewhere.
Is it?
I also love the fact that, you know, we have the voice, you know, the psychic that Faye Dunaway kind of mentioned earlier on in the film. You know, she's part of this, and they have like these little segments of the soundstage that are for these individuals that are going to make up the rest of the news. Like, basically, it's a variety hour. You have Howard Beale, mm-hmm. that's kind of the opener. You know, he gives the opening monologue, and then you jump straight to these different people, but we never get to see their parts of the show.
They're not important.
Oh, no, that skeleton in the closet lady seemed pretty interesting.
I would love to see the skeleton in the closet. And I also wanted to see that Truthatron, that computer that apparently is like a fact checker.
Well, I thought it was Vox Populi, which to me sounds like opinion polls. We're going to throw a question out, call 10,000 people, boom, hey, they're going to answer.
I thought
it was like a truth checker, like, you know, like a lie detector. Maybe it's ambiguous. Maybe no one knows what that thing actually does.
Mm.
But I also love the fact that when Faye Dunaway is talking about how all these different parts of the Howard Beale show have their own demographics, like, who would watch the robot for half an hour?
Yeah.
Toasters, maybe.
Ooh.
Ouch.
Statisticians.
Are you trying to be offensive to the non-sentient fan base that we might have here at Art House Legends? Is that your take?
I'll be getting a very angry letter from my blender later, I think.
I'm definitely curious. And if you are a non-sentient being who is listening to this podcast, well, please feel free to send us an email at arthouselegends@gmail.com, and I will get back to you as soon as possible.
Damn Internet of Things always downloading our podcasts.
Yep, them bots, you know.
Yeah.
They will achieve consciousness, and at that particular point, then we have more to worry about than fake news, put it that way. But one thing I really am fascinated by when it comes to Howard Beale's show is when he shows up, he's got a glass, a stained glass in the background, kind of almost religious-like.
Oh, yeah. It's a temple. Yeah, it's a church, but... Yeah.
They're definitely playing...
Even though it's prophet. Not... It's not a cross, so it's not a holy symbol. It's just kind of a pretty design, but yeah, it looks like a stained glass design.
Well, not just that, but I mean, how does he punctuate his show? He punctuates it by fainting.
Fainting, right.
And so,
which
you can't tell
is that
a combination of the stained glass, the pew-like nature of the audience, the fact that they are all kind of getting caught up in the insanity of what Howard is saying, and him fainting doesn't have this kind of religious fervor to it,
Is that more common in your area? Because I've only heard of it kind of stereotyped.
Oh, it's a stereotype. Yeah. I mean, it's actually, yeah. I think it's interesting. Another movie that also showed this kind of religiosity and fainting was The Blues Brothers. I mean, James Brown. I mean, and I was going to say that the someone probably even loved James Brown a little bit too much. Because it also has that theatricality for that as well. But it's also interesting enough that did anyone realize, or I guess here's a question that should be asked. How much change does Howard Beale actually do? What changes in the world?
They get mad.
He can.
What does that
he mean? Can.
But yeah. Do they do anything with that anger?
No, they just get mad. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, he's pointing the crowd in a direction. He's guiding the mob, but I don't think the mob is doing anything.
Well, I mean, let's put it this way. His second sermon, and I'm going to call them sermons because that's pretty much what it sounds like, especially considering that he's shouting at the top of his lungs. His second sermon, he's telling people to turn off their TVs as they're watching him. Yet he still keeps his audience, which means that what are they not doing?
Well, then they don't do that, but then they'll send all those telegrams to the White House?
Yeah,
but what does that really do? I mean, it's kind of like that change.org. You know, you can create a petition, but what does it really do, though?
We don't know if telegrams were treated the same way they treat email. Like, oh, well, it's another telegram. Ignore it.
Well, let me put it this way. Does the merger still happen? The one that Beale was trying to fight against?
I bet it does.
Oh, he does.
Because he just kind of comes out and sweeps it under the rug. Yeah, it's not happening. Nobody's fact-checking him.
Well, that's because do they really care if it happens or not? And again, we could also talk about, when we talk about John Oliver. I mean, let's look at the FCC thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, John Oliver, that was the thing that really built him up, was when he went after the FCC. Yet, did that really change anything?
Well, no, I guess net neutrality is dead right now, so...
So, all hell are corporate overlords? Make sure you bow. Yes. Bow, bow. Don't... We gotta grovel a little bit here. Otherwise, our podcast is gonna be even deader than it already is. But, yeah. But I also love the fact that this does get Howard to see the president of the company, right? And we get to what I think is easily the best scene in the movie. And I'm just going to say this right now when it comes to this scene. Why the fuck did Ned Beatty never do anything like this ever again? Holy shit! This is incredible! This one scene is... How did he get stuck playing second fiddle to Gene Hackman in Superman after this? Why did he get stuck doing Burt Reynolds movies after doing this? Where did this come from? I mean, did y'all know that he could do this?
Nope.
I
mean, were y'all as surprised as how he did this? I mean, because at the end of this scene, my jaw was on the floor. I mean, this is just an amazing monologue. This is an amazing scene. Not just the way that Ned Beatty is, you know, just chewing the scenery like it's paper, but the way it's shot, the way it's edited, the way that it goes back to Howard and the fear in his eyes as Ned Beatty is just laying the smack down. I mean, this is an insane sequence, right? I mean, what were your impressions of this scene? What did you think about this just insane, like, I want to say 5 to 7 minutes of just greed is good, all hail capitalism, you know, tirade. I mean, this is... I want to know. I'm like...
Welcome to Valhalla. We're going to scream at you now about what you've done wrong.
Okay, maybe we should make this very clear. Yeah. Everybody in this movie screams. Everybody in this movie shouts, and everybody has a monologue. Even Max's wife, who's in the movie, I'm not kidding here, only 2 hours and 6 seconds, shouts. And she also got an Oscar win.
Is that 2 minutes and 6 seconds?
2 minutes, 6 seconds. Timed.
Oh, you said hours.
Oh. No, the movie is 2 hours. Yeah.
Okay.
No, okay. No, her scene is 2 minutes and 6 seconds.
Okay.
And if I'm not correct, I think the movie is like 2 hours and 5 minutes. 2 hours.
Something like that.
Yeah. But yeah, she...
2 hours, 1 minute. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, this movie also has this movie has a record of having the best... a best actor, or in this case, best supporting actress, who was in the film for the shortest amount of time, yet won the Academy Award.
So weird.
Yeah. And she's only in the movie for 2 scenes. And 1 scene is almost a blink and you miss it.
Yeah.
But what did you think about, but what did you think about this Nebe scene? I have to know. This is, to me, this is like one of the greatest scenes of all time.
It was unsuspected. Like, yeah. I didn't know what he was going to do leading him into the room. Like, at first it seemed like he was going to, like, congratulate him or reward him or some shit.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. Let me give you something over here. And then it's just fucking berating for 5 minutes. It's like, holy shit, somebody more crazy than fucking,
What did, because I went back to this scene over and over and over again. Because this scene just impressed me. Understand, like, this, the Mad as Hell is the most memorable scene in the movie. This is the one that anytime you talk about Network, people remember Mad as Hell. Mm-hmm. But look at how this scene is staged. You have Ned Beatty putting Howard at one end of this massive table, this massive kind of corporate table, right? It's dark, and the only thing that's lighting this are these lamps that are on the table itself. And then Ned Beatty goes all the way to the end of the table, on the other end. And the way that the sound is mixed, it's, you know, he's shouting into this very, very empty room. So you're hearing a lot of echo that's happening as he's shouting at the top of his lungs. And he just sounds like the voice of God. I mean, that's how he comes off. And this is all on Ned Beatty. The way that he shouts, the way that he comes storming to the other side of the table, just barreling down on Howard as he's giving this rant over about 5 minutes, just ranting and ranting and moving closer and closer, just kind of all-encompassing Howard and just terrifying the shit out of him. I mean, you look at the way he looks like he's seeing the face of God, right? I mean, that's kind of how it feels.
Oh, he pissed his pants.
Yeah.
And but at the very end... Yeah, go ahead. Hmm.
He has to, like, the way he establishes the atmosphere before he starts yelling at him, I thought was interesting. Like, he has to close the curtains. There's only lights on the table. And it's just, like, mm-hmm. Just, like, the room he's in is so, like, fucking intricate. And there's, like, shit on the walls or, like, these fucking, it's, like, paintings and shit, right?
Yeah.
Just, like, yeah. Just, let me show you this fantastic room and let me just fucking lay into you for 5 minutes straight.
But what about you, Kent? What did you think about this scene?
It came out of nowhere. So
really, it came out of nowhere?
Well, I expected. I expected a dressing down because he has offended the gods.
Well,
of Network,
he's fucking with the bottom
was,
line.
Right, right. And, but just how
the only
it was
other scene
done.
He had, he didn't have any. He was just kind of like, "You're doing a good job," and that was it. That's all you saw of him.
Well,
and then
what
this.
I love about that scene, though, is that Hackett called it, you know?
Yeah. But nobody could call this, see? So that's
But here's the thing about that this scene, though. Because after he's done shouting, right, and he allows Howard to speak, Howard asks, why me? Why do you? Why am I to give this message? Because that's what Ned Beatty wants me to do. Is I want you to spread the message of capitalism through your words. You know, this is what he's doing for the last 5 minutes. And then when Howard says, why me? What is his response? The exact same words that Howard said that the angel told him the night, you know, right. The night before the Mattis Helsey. It ties back to that.
Crazy.
And it's also interesting that when everyone's trying to pull Howard off the air, who's the one who's keeping him from being pulled off the air?
Yeah. He's one of the guys stopping him.
No, they call it. Ned Beatty. Because, you know, Hackett's all upset because, like, he's killing her ratings.
Thanks.
And Ned Beatty's telling him, so what? This is more important than ratings.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious considering that this also ties back to the beginning of the film where Beale is going to be fired because of ratings.
Yeah.
But there's one other scene that I really want to talk about because this scene made me laugh so fucking hard, and I want to know what y'all thought. What did y'all think about the contract negotiations with the Liberation Front and the lawyers?
Yes! Perfection. So
that it was
just staring at young Lance Henriksen the whole time.
How did I miss him?
It was totally Lance Henriksen, man. Come on.
How could you not see him? I mean, it's like he was the only face in that crowd that I remembered.
The guy next to him, like to his right, looked familiar, but I couldn't place him if he was anybody.
I don't think so.
But... He's an uncredited. Oh shit! I didn't miss him.
What did you think of this scene,
considering the irony of it all?
Yeah, the communist arguing over contracts to get money and arguing over the individual parts of it more so than the capitalists are arguing. So
yeah, I'm not going to lose my end of the shares. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
I laugh so fucking hard on that. But at the same time, though, it's also kind of tying back into the whole idea of the corrupt nature of capitalism, right?
Right.
The corrupt nature of greed. That, in a way, that you know, these are supposed to be, the people that we're supposed to be rooting for. Yet at the same time, you know, the whole point of them actually getting the show is because they're robbing banks. So, you know, take that for what you say. But I think that the funny thing about this all is that technically speaking, the money that they're making on these contracts sounds like they're making more money off the TV show than they would at the scores that they're going to be performing.
Yeah.
You know, these bank heists, right?
Probably. Yep.
So I just...
Which means you could almost fake some of these bank robberies if you wanted to.
You could, but the whole thing is that they have to be real. This has to be counterculture. You can't. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, technically speaking, what we're seeing here is the birth of Investigation Discovery.
Not reality TV.
Well, I mean, let me put it this way: if they were like filming the Liberation Front bitching and griping about each other, then yes, that would be the birth of reality TV. Although I have to admit, the real world terrorists. Or, you know, the real world liberation movement type of thing, you know, MTV style. Oh, come on,
it would get ratings, yeah. Yeah. The cops would always be trying to infiltrate the crew just to figure out, okay, we know there's like a 4-week delay, they plan this stuff in advance, and we get to see the planning, so.
Yeah. I love this scene. I also love the fact that all this ties together when we get to the end of the film, right?
Yeah.
But there's also one other element. Because I have to ask a question. Who do you think is the most important character in this movie? Who do you think is the one that is that the film is really focused the most on?
I want to say Beale, but then... No, he's not. He's kind of... what everybody else revolves around. But in a way, he's
the force
not
of nature. He's the guy. Yeah. He's the guy who starts things off. But is the movie really about him?
Ooh. Or is it about the network as an entity, as a person of itself?
That is a cop out answer, man. Come on.
Corporations are people, man. Yeah.
Well, technically speaking, I mean, think about, because the movie is called Network. But at the same time, though, if you look at kind of how all the different factions work for and against each other, you know, because, you know, yeah, you have this TV studio, but the studio is owned by a business. The business is looking to sell the TV show or the TV studio to another business. You also have the Liberation Movement, which is its own entity, yet is being used by the TV show to sell products. Most likely the products that the company that owns the TV show is trying to sell. So there, in a way, you could say that this is all about these entities tied up in this unholy marriage, this vile, disgusting display of greed and capitalism, right? Because this movie is very anti-capitalist. Can we all agree about this? That it is wanting to show the despicable beast of this, right?
Yeah. The anything from money.
In a way,
side.
I'm actually gonna side with Kent on this one. This is all tied together. Or at least that's kind of what I'm getting from all this. I mean, Chris.
That was gonna be your answer if he hadn't said that, though.
Actually, I would say yeah. I think he actually helped me kind of find my footing in that. You know, and
God damn it, Kent.
Yeah.
I mean, but if you disagree, by all means. I mean, I would like
it makes sense. I'm just mostly just being stupid. But,
hey, we all have that, but yeah. But no, I mean, and especially and I think it also needs. But I guess the question still remains, though. If it's not Beale, who is the most important character in this movie?
I mean, if I was hard pressed to put it on one person, I was going to say Diana. So.
Actually, I'm gonna agree with you on that one, Chris, because honestly, she's the. I mean, even though Howard is the one who starts it, she's the one who creates this. She takes Howard Beale and she builds a show around it. She not only builds a show, she builds UBS, the whole station around this. She is the idea person, and on top of
she has other.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say she has other people she answers to, but she seems like the one making the most moves to get her vision, this vision of a perfect show, perfect network, you know, off the ground, rolling, whatever, and running with it. So that's why I said, yeah.
But does the what do you think the film thinks of her, though? What is the film wanting us to think of her? Are we supposed to sympathize with her? Are we supposed to hate her? Are we supposed to be... I mean, what emotions do you get that we should be feeling towards her?
I mean, as a character, I felt like she just... She never turned herself off. She was always in work mode. You know, she's a workaholic, and that shit never went away. Even... She probably did all that shit in her sleep, too, talking... All that shit. So, like, especially, like, once Max leaves, she's, like, totally... She basically says she's not in tune with human emotions, you know? She's basically a robot for the network.
She's
for her job.
She's practically planning some of that stuff during sex, so...
Yeah!
She just keeps talking to her, like... Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, we should totally move so-and-so. Blah, blah, blah.
Well, the thing is she's not satisfied with human connection, right? I mean, she even outright says it, you know, when she's in that first dinner with Max. You know, it's like, well, I'm terrible at human connection. You know, when it comes to sex, I get off really early, and I just want to be done with it. You know, I don't have these types of responses when it comes to emotions, and we see that over and over again. You know, she kind of acts like a guy, right? You know, she obsesses about her work like a guy.
Yeah.
She, I mean, her sex life is pretty much like a guy. I mean, she busts balls better than the guys do in this movie.
She does.
I mean, yeah. she is the perfect. You know, she's perfect for this type of lifestyle. You know, she is all about moving upward, but she's also an ideas person. She has big ideas, and those ideas pay off, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it weren't for the fact that Ned Beatty basically poisoned the well of their moneymaker by having him, you know, kind of spew the gospel of capitalism and how nobody is special, you know, basically depressing the audience, except for apparently some really hardcore people, you know, that's... You know, she would have kept, I mean, this train would have kept rolling if it weren't for that, right?
Probably, yeah.
And what does she do? She finds the solution. She finds what it is that they need to do to get the wheels back on. And, okay, so when she proposes killing Howard, what did you think about that moment?
Wow, this movie has gone off the rail.
I didn't know they were actually going to go through with it. I thought they were just like... Because they'd mentioned it before, and it was like, oh, I'm going to kill him, blah, blah, blah. And then it was like, oh, we got to keep him on because so-and-so says so, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And,
or character,
you know, 18 bullet shots later, yeah, he's fucking dead.
Or, you know, do a character assassination on him, but what left is there to character assassinate?
But the thing is we have one scene that helps us believe that she would do this. And that's her final scene with Max, right? When he's trying to get her to open up to him, to accept his love. And when she can't do it, when we can see that she is incapable of doing that, we know at that moment when she says, we got to kill him, we know she's serious, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, there's no doubt in it. When I'm watching it, there's no doubt in my mind. She would do it. In fact, I have a feeling if you were to put the gun in her hand, she would have gone up point blank, put one in the middle of his head, and just called it that, right?
Probably, yeah.
But it's better ratings if it's a liberation movement that does it.
It becomes the crossover with the new show.
Yeah,
it's basically
great advertising.
It's the pilot for the new show.
No. That show's almost been on the air. And it's
oh, it has
good
been?
Ratings.
Okay.
Just a lead-in for, like, the series premiere or some shit?
Howard's the lead-in for this show. That's what that lady was screaming about, you know, being tied with Howard, because when Howard's ratings are slipping, people are turning off UBS. They're not sticking around for the next show.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's why she's screaming about getting Howard off the air. You know, you're fucking with our ratings. So,
okay.
Yeah. So I think it's, and I think that it's kind of funny that the lead-in show is, or the follow-up show is the one that kills Howard. And of course, it also ties to the final joke in the movie. What did y'all think about the final joke in the movie? Anyway, didn't it feel like the punchline of a joke?
A very dark humor, like, something you'd see out of another dystopia book.
But you laughed. Admit it. You laughed.
Oh, yeah.
Chris, did you laugh?
I don't think I did.
What? how could you not? That is... I have to wonder. Like, are you a humanoid? Is that it?
Probably. Probably.
But no, I just... It is dark. It is a dark joke, but one that just ties a little bow on this, right? Because in a way, nothing's gonna change. Right? I mean, Howard dies. The show is off the air. The other shows that are on the Howard Beale show get their own spinoffs, and those become the lead-in for the the liberation movement, right? Yeah. For the Mao Zedong Hour.
Mao Zedong.
Hey, that, I didn't call it that.
Okay.
You can thank Diane for that one.
Okay.
But what did y'all think as the movie was over? I'll be honest here. Every time I watch this movie, I have to use the credits to collect myself a little bit. I can't just turn it off. What is the feeling that you have after the movie's over?
First time, I was just confused. Like, my God, they did shoot him off.
Not only did they shoot him off, but the thing is that the cameras were placed where you got both the killers.
Yeah.
And you could cut back and forth between Howard getting shot and the killers. And the thing is you don't actually, well, you know, as the credits are going on, you're actually watching the other channels, right? You're watching the other news shows reporting on Howard's murder, and they're using the same footage, which is of the three camera shots between between Howard and the two killers. So it was all edited together, right?
Almost planned from the start. Gee, I wonder.
Oh, it was planned. I mean, we know it is planned. And it seems like everyone accepts that it was planned. But what are they going to do about it? I mean, this is the studio that's helping terrorists rob banks.
For ratings.
But what about you, Chris? What's the emotions that you're feeling after this movie's over?
I don't know if I had any emotions when it ended. I feel like I need to watch it again. I only watched it once, so... I mean, I guess...
It's one of those movies that you have to kind of mull over a little bit.
Yeah.
Think about. All right. Fair enough, fair enough. There's just one other thing I want to talk about before we get into Geek Sheet. Did anyone else notice how invasive the television cameras get in the movie itself? How, especially when we're watching the Howard Beale show, just how those cameras seem to keep pushing in and keep pushing in and keep pushing in, and that you're seeing that the cameras are as prevalent in the shot as any of the actors. Like, especially like when Howard's taking his ranting and raving, the camera is also in the shot. Do y'all notice that?
No.
I mean, I'm noticing it more thinking back on it and you pointing it out. Because, like, at the time, you're just kind of... Like, the first time, you know, the only time I watched it, it was just kind of like, oh, they're filming it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's just what I'm thinking. But, like, now that you're mentioning it, it's like it's... was really close to his face.
Yeah.
Well, it's also interesting because whenever you're watching Howard on the television set, it almost has his it's almost entirely his face every single time.
Yeah. With that.
So yeah, it's like it wants to just force him into that camera, force him into that frame.
Yeah, the face is the biggest window into his craziness. So.
That was the typical what you did with. TV personalities get right in close to him, but I kind of would expect it to be more of a distance, switch the lens to a longer thing instead of bring the camera right up to his nose. Mm-hmm. But
what about you, Ken? Did you notice the camera position?
I wasn't paying attention, but now that you mention it, yeah, most of the movie camera positions are set so he is staring at the camera, or the camera's where you can see where he's looking at it. So, with the biggest one being at the end when he gets shot and the camera literally just moves over him, like, what the hell? Like, the guy isn't faking this. Maybe you can get out and check to see if he's alive? I don't know.
And also, do you notice how the cameraman never seems to be in frame? The in a way that the camera almost seems to be sentient?
The camera is more the subject than the cameraman.
Yeah. But anyway, is there anything else about the film that you wanted to bring up before we get into Geek Sheet?
One question. Is this not an American Blu-ray?
It is.
It is? Okay.
It is?
Yes. In fact, Warner Brothers did a really good job with the transfer.
Okay. I was just looking on Amazon and I only saw the Canadian release for it, I think.
I think it might be out of print right now.
Oh.
Well, no, what that usually means is that another company is interested in picking it up, and considering that this is MGM, I have a strange feeling I know what company it is, and if it does, I want that copy very, very much.
Does it start for C?
You know which one I'm talking about, too.
Does it start for C?
More than likely.
Yeah, okay.
I let's put it this way. I have a wide collection of those movies.
A collection that starts with a C?
Yes.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yes. They should sponsor us.
Anything else before we get into Geek Sheet?
Oh, let's see. What have I covered? Don't they mention broadcasting executions at one point?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
If it was, then it was something that was meant to is kind of like a
skip.
A subtle bit of foreshadowing.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I love this movie enough, and I guess I'm tipping my hand there, but I will definitely be checking to see if it was there, okay. And I just missed it.
Wasn't sure if I was projecting, so.
It actually might be.
Yeah.
I don't remember it.
Yeah.
But all right, so let's go ahead and let's do it. Kent, what do we have for the Geek Sheet?
Oh, got a lot here. Well, actually, not too. We have a lot, but not too much. I only picked out six particulars here. So, Faye Dunaway, who is back to us from Chinatown, from our previous episode on Chinatown. And did you know she was in the Supergirl movie?
Really?
Yes, I'm grabbing that.
Oh my god, I tried to forget that and you had to remember.
Yes,
thank
I
you
did.
So
and you're,
much.
Yeah.
You're fired from DC.
William Holden was in the Second Omen movie, the original Casino Royale, and a movie from the 70s that I'm kind of surprised isn't talked about more anymore, Towering Inferno.
A skyscraper. I have a feeling we'll be talking about
you
it at some
so?
Point.
Okay.
But I'm surprised that you've forgotten that we've talked about Mr. Holden before in Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, it's that. Okay. Well, dang, then all these people are a returning champion because Robert Duvall from Godfather 1 and 2 and Kill a Mockingbird and was also the original Frank Burns in MASH, which
yes,
I'm sure we'll get to.
Robert Altman's MASH.
Yeah, well, the movie. Ned Beatty was, yeah. In Superman, being bad. Now, the kidnapped heiress role here is played by Kathy Cronkite, who is Walter Cronkite's daughter. Mm-hmm. So we actually have two Cronkites in this movie, technically, with the archive footage of Walter and then her. And our great con, Arthur Burkhart. Now, he hasn't done that much on camera, but he's done a crap ton of voice actor work. And he is the bad guy of my heavily bad guy of my childhood. So, could you guess any of his roles? Just from the little you've heard? I'll tell you this. He wears a heavy mask in probably the most famous one of the two.
Batman?
No. He was Destro. The voice of Destro in all the G.I. Joe cartoons.
Nice.
And also in Transformers, who's the voice of Devastator.
I wouldn't have caught that one.
Yeah, I would never in a million years try flipping through and it's like, oh my god. And he's still doing voice work today, so. Yeah. There's some pulled out. Yeah! So am I rehired? No? Okay. Yeah. My ratings went up.
We'll keep around for a few. For
yeah,
a few.
Let you know.
Yeah.
We're coming close to 200. After 201, then.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Rediscussing your contract.
I have a contract?
You can still clean out your locker, though. So, you
know. I have a locker?
Oh, I should just do it anyway because, man, it's starting to stink. All right, so, gentlemen, let's go ahead and let's do this. Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on Network? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Chris?
It's a pass for me. I feel like there's a lot here that I feel like I need to see it at least a few more times to really like, oh shit, that's how this fits there, you know, whatever. But I love the screenplay. That was great. Engrossed the whole time. Just really great cast. Just a solid pass for me.
Kent.
Oh yeah, it's a pass. I could see why this won the awards it did. It was kind of a tough year. In a tough year for awards, because there was a lot of stuff that was up there. This, man, 76 was just a good year. What the hell?
All right, here's the question, though. Would you have picked Rocky or Network as your best picture?
I think I'm still with Rocky as best picture, but it wasn't the knockout. It goes to the judges in a tally and split decision.
So split decision.
Yeah.
So Rocky would only win by points?
Yep.
How about you, Chris?
This network.
All right, so I don't think I have to tell you. I absolutely love this movie. This is actually one of my all-time favorite films. It's in my top 100, and for good reason, because this movie is so intrinsic. I mean, it's so every scene has something to play, and the way that Sidney Lumet takes those scenes and he just molds them into this wonderful story that, I will admit, does have a lot of shouting and a lot of screaming and a lot of monologuing, which can be very annoying if that's something that you have a problem with. But in this particular film, this is about television. This is, in a way, you have to have these types of theatrics in this movie in order for it to kind of resonate to what it's trying to go for and the kind of warning it was trying to make about television. And especially, like I said, between this and A Face in the Crowd, these are the warning signs of what television will become. And I don't think that there's anyone here that would deny that we are living in the nightmare that Network was warning us of. Where, especially when it comes to news and when it comes to how information is given to us, this movie warned us about it long before it actually happened. And I only wish that we could kind of go back and heed that warning a little bit more. But we can't. And we have this to kind of show us where it all went wrong. And I can't say enough great things about it. The acting's incredible. Direction's incredible. Paddy Chayefsky's screenplay is amazing. I'm happy that Peter Finch got the nomination and won, especially considering that this is his last role. Faye Dunaway is an amazing performance here. This is amazing. And then, of course, she went off and did Supergirl. Yeah, well, it also should be said that last year she was in A Case for Christ. So, she's fallen very, very far. But she's still got Network. And that's all you need, in my opinion. So, yes, hard pass. Love this film. And I'm so glad that we got a chance to talk about it. Kent, what do we got next coming up?
We have, according to our list here, we have a film that's actually Chris's choice for this month to celebrate something.
So, Chris, do you want to give us a little something about this movie?
I'm going to want to get your whack bats and you want to steal a bunch of shit from three scary-looking white dudes because we're doing Fantastic Mr. Fox.
We're finally getting to Wes Anderson, a filmmaker that I really cannot wait to talk about, although there's probably other movies I would be more excited about talking about. But hey, Fantastic Mr. Fox is our next episode. And if you have anything you'd like to say about this episode or any of our other episodes, you can certainly do so on our Facebook page as well as on Twitter at Art House Legends. Or if you want to just send us a small little message, you can do so at arthouselegends@gmail.com. And I will get back to you as soon as possible. Gentlemen, thank you so much for sharing this movie with me. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And me.